As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
As much as Japan remains a patriarchal society, progress is being made. But that is giving plenty of Japanese men an identity crisis, with sometimes tragic outcomes. We speak with a man who started a helpline that's now ringing off the hook.
And Americans love big cars. And the reason may not be as simple as Americans liking lots of things big. A loophole in some long-ago efficiency regulations might be partly to blame. So we ask, if the loophole is closed, will American cars start to shrink? First up, though. In northwest Moscow on Friday, just after 8 p.m., a man films himself inside Crocus City Hall saying, "Someone is shooting here." He was there with hundreds of others to see a rock concert. A group of armed men entered the venue and started firing. Then they set the concert hall on fire. Smoke and flames trapped more than 200 people as the ceiling collapsed. 28 people suffocated after seeking refuge in a toilet, and at least 137 are now known to have died. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack, and four men have since been arrested and charged. But it was only after a full 19 hours that President Vladimir Putin finally addressed the Russian people.
Обращаюсь к вам в связи с кровавым варварским террористическим актом, жертвами которого стали десятки мирных, ни в чем не повинных людей.
Lamenting the loss of life, but omitting one rather significant point.
Vladimir Putin didn't mention the very important fact that Russia had been tipped off by American intelligence services, giving them a warning that an attack from Islamic State was highly likely to happen, and had advised people to stay away from large venues, including concert halls.
Chris Lockwood is The Economist's Europe editor.
He'd actually simply said that that was fake news, propaganda designed to destabilize Russia. And then when the attack did happen, which was a lot later, in fact, than the Americans had suggested it might happen, it clearly was still a massive intelligence failure, and Putin simply won't admit to that.
What do we know so far about the attackers and their motives?
Well, it's extremely murky, of course, as everything in Russia is these days. But four suspected gunmen have been caught. In fact, this morning, they have been put on trial in Moscow. They've apparently even pleaded guilty, but they have clearly been beaten up. One of them is wearing a very heavy bandage on his head. And at least two of them are said to be Tajiks, people from Central Asia, but living supposedly in Russia. What we know about them is that Islamic State has claimed responsibility for this attack. Now, we don't know whether these people actually are Islamic State operatives or whether they claim to be, but that's the expectation, that it really was an Islamic State attack. And Islamic State holds Russia responsible for the devastation of Afghanistan in the past. It's very angry with Russia for intervening in Syria on the side of Bashar al-Assad, who is fighting Islamic State in that country. And this is not the first time that Islamic State has tried to carry out attacks in Russia.
So it sounds like Putin can't blame Ukraine for this one.
Putin stopped short in his address to the nation of directly implicating Ukraine in carrying out the attacks. All he did was say that Ukraine was connected to the attack in that, as he said, they had opened a window for the attackers to escape.
Где по предварительным данным для них с украинской стороны было подготовлено окно для перехода государственной границы.
Now this seems to be complete nonsense. For a start, the attackers who did flee Moscow before they were apprehended were heading in a direction that makes it look as though they were much closer to Belarus than to the Ukrainian border. And the idea that you could get across the Ukrainian border in the middle of a war, there are essentially two lines of troops, a Russian line and a Ukrainian line, and it would be quite suicidal to try and cross that border. So it's a sort of laughable claim, and he produced no evidence whatsoever to support it. And part of the reason why Mr. Putin probably hasn't directly implicated Ukraine is he doesn't know exactly what the Americans have in terms of intelligence and what they might be about to reveal in the next few days. And that could be very embarrassing for him if he's painting Ukraine as the author of it, and then the Americans can produce very convincing explanations of how it was Islamic State, perhaps how these people were recruited, which is why he's saying, you know, pretty minimal amounts.
You say that there's some potential embarrassment here, but how much could this intelligence blunder damage Putin?
Well, potentially, this is very bad indeed for Putin. Putin has always projected himself as the brave, strong defender of Russia. That's his whole shtick in appealing to his people. And it's not unsuccessful. You know, he, of course, massively inflates his vote in elections. But the fact is, a lot of Russians do like him and like the idea of having a leader who is tough and strong and stands up to the West and other enemies. So when there's a massive, and this really is a massive intelligence failure on this scale, and it's not just that the attacks were not foreseen and prevented. It's also that once the attacks happened, the response of the authorities was really quite slow. Even though there was a police station actually in the concert venue itself, there was no proper response for almost an hour. And a lot of people died who perhaps might have been saved if the response had been a bit faster. So yes, I think this is potentially very damaging for Putin. And as a result, he will probably have to tighten up his repression even further to make sure that there aren't any protests about it.
Tighten up his repression even further. In what way?
Well, we already see that migrant communities in Russia, they're already feeling the pinch. There are raids on mosques and hostels reported even before this and after it too. People have been talking about cancelling Russia's moratorium on the death penalty for terrorism. And of course, that's a particularly nasty thing to hear in the context of Russia, because the Kremlin calls anyone that criticizes the war a terrorist. And then if terrorism can attract the death penalty, then you can see that even quite straightforward, simple dissent could lead to the death penalty. And he's also hinted that the main consequences of this attack will anyway be felt in Ukraine, where he will probably use it to justify his call for another 300 or 400,000 extra troops to fight the next phase of the war.
So effectively, he's trying to spin this tragedy to his advantage.
Yes, that's clear. Already, media linked to the Kremlin, which basically is all of the media in Russia now, they're already busily at work of putting out this narrative that suggests that Ukraine had a hand, that enemies are everywhere. One of them published an investigation over the weekend suggesting that the people who were apprehended may have been recruited by the Ukrainian embassy in Tajikistan, again, without producing any evidence. They never produce evidence for that sort of thing. Over the weekend, we saw a big spike recorded in the activity of social media bots controlled by the FSB, which is Russia's internal security agency, often retelling the stories that the official media were trying to put out. And this fake news blamed Ukraine, but also America and even Britain for in some way being involved in this attack. The Ukrainians are very concerned that this is going to be used as a pretext for further mobilization and further attacks on Ukraine. And we've already seen, actually, in the last day or so, another big barrage of missile attacks, in this case on the western city of Lviv. And that's really a part of the country that hasn't been hit very much in recent months. So there are a lot of signs that Russia is already revving up its air campaign against Ukraine. And this will just be further justification in Putin's eyes for going on and doing that. It's sadly entirely possible that this attack, terrible failure though it actually is, will end up being to Putin's advantage.
Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
Fukushima Michihito had decided he wanted to marry his girlfriend.
Moika Iida writes about Japan for The Economist.
But a decade ago, when he was 30 years old, he fell ill, had to stop working, and as a result, broke up with her. He said he felt as if he can't work and provide for his family, he shouldn't get married at all. And later on, he came to realize that a lot of Japanese men are struggling because of this pressure to fill the traditional male role. He now runs a men's hotline in Osaka, west of Japan, and encourages men to discuss their anxieties. Mr. Fukushima explained that at the time the hotline was established back in the 90s, there were a lot of services targeting women, but there was nothing like that for men. In Japan, the relations between men and women are shifting. You see that in declining marriage rates and also more women entering the workforce. But surprisingly, this idea that men are supposed to be breadwinners remains deeply entrenched. It seems like in Japan, men are facing an identity crisis.
So what signs are there of this identity crisis that you describe?
Well, I think there's a lot of men out there who know that women's roles in society are changing, so therefore their roles are supposed to change as well. But culture change is very slow here. For instance, there's growing calls for men to take parental leave, but in 2022, only 17% of eligible men actually took parental leave, whereas 80% of women did. And Japanese men spend far less time on chores compared to men in other countries. I write a lot about gender and women's issues here, and I tend to have this idea that men are oppressors, but I think men are also struggling a lot because of these rigid gender roles. So I came across a survey by a group called Lean in Tokyo, and it suggested that over 60% of Japanese men feel uncomfortable at their workplaces because they feel this pressure to behave in a manly way. And Japan has a very dark issue. Japan has the highest suicide rates in the world, but actually men are twice as likely to kill themselves as women.
And so the hotline that Mr. Fukushima runs that you mentioned, is it to address that suicide issue?
The hotline Mr. Fukushima runs is aimed at giving men a safe space to air their grievances and share their anxieties, and it receives calls on a wide range of topics. Some people talk about their relationships, they talk about their sexuality, and also issues at their workplaces. Mr. Fukushima told me that there's a growing number of men in Japan who are growing tired of behaving in a manly way. And he also said, compared to women, men have a hard time expressing their weaknesses, as in there's such a strong cultural pressure to be strong all the time. He mentioned when people call the hotline, they're a bit reluctant to talk. They say something like, this is a very trivial thing. Is it okay for me to talk about it? And on the contrary, he told me that some men start getting aggressive over the phone, probably because they're embarrassed about showing their intimate problems.
But how did these gender roles become so entrenched that they've led to what is clearly becoming a kind of crisis for Japanese men?
So I spoke to some sociologists who are focused on masculinity studies, and they told me that a lot of the gender roles we see today were cemented during Japan's economic high growth period in the post-war. So at the time, Japanese families settled into this model of the salaryman husband and stay-at-home mom. But in the 1970s, when the oil crisis hit, these rigid rules started to break down in a lot of Western countries, and that's because more women entered the workforce in response to economic stagnation and labor shortages. But Japan tried to overcome this crisis by making men work even harder. And then the country soon entered the so-called bubble economy of the 1980s. Japan missed the opportunity to change. But things have started to change since then. So in the 1990s, the government grew more concerned about Japan's falling birth rate, and we started to see more women enter the workforce as well. And that has led to calls for men to take on the burden of domestic work, mainly to free women's time and allow them to work more freely. And in the 2010s, the government promoted this idea of ikemen, which combines the words ikuji in Japanese, which means child rearing, and ikemen, which means cool men. So it tried to make the idea of men taking on the burden of domestic work fashionable.
But from what you're saying, it's not clear that government efforts and hotlines and all of these shifts in ideas are actually helping much. There still seems to be, as we said, a crisis for a lot of Japanese men.
Yes, I think culture change is slow at many companies or institutions. A lot of men, because they're forced to commit their whole lives to work, they don't really have a life outside of it. So there's a Japanese slang called nureochibazoku, which means wet fallen leaf, and that refers to men who have retired and are at home. And because these men don't have hobbies of their own or don't have friends and don't know what to do with their free time, they follow their wives all the time like a wet leaf stuck to a shoe. And there are people like Mr. Fukushima who are very aware of these problems and hope things will change, but he also acknowledges that it's a learning process for him as well. So I asked him if he could hop on a time machine and go back to that moment when he was 30 and with his girlfriend who he was hoping to marry. How would he behave now that he's so aware of gender problems?
もし自分がその30歳の時に戻れたら、なんかどういう対応してたと思いますか？
どういうのは結婚関連でってこと
ですか？そうですね。
いや、同じことやったんじゃないですかね。
And surprisingly, he said he'd still do the same thing, as in he would break up with her. He spent all this time thinking about gender roles and the need to challenge them, but it's still hard to truly challenge those ideas. He mentioned even if he's comfortable with the idea of financially depending on his wife or being a stay-at-home husband, what would his partner think? And what would people around them think? Even the people who spend a lot of time thinking about these ideas and stereotypes still have a hard time challenging these entrenched views.
Thanks very much for your time, Moeka.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's an unavoidable truth about American vehicles. They're just big. SUVs and trucks account for more than half of automobile sales. Is it that Americans just like their transportation huge? Maybe. Or maybe the car industry just loves to sell them big cars. There's a little-known bit of regulation that's soon going to change, and that will reveal which is the greater force.
A federal policy introduced decades ago has incentivized the sale of big cars.
Carla Subirana is a digital journalist at The Economist.
But the loophole that has allowed cars to get bigger and bigger might now be coming to an end, and it could force Americans to downsize their huge vehicles.
So what is this loophole that you're talking about?
Well, it goes back to the oil crisis that happened in America back in the 70s. In 1973, Arab countries stopped supplying oil to America to punish it for supporting Israel in the Yom Kippur War. And that was very damaging for the economy because it led to an increase in fuel prices, inflation, and a deep recession. So in response to the crisis, the federal government decided that it wanted to make fuel use more efficient. And in 1975, it imposed fuel economy standards on car makers. Essentially, it forced all new cars to become more efficient. And the car makers weren't very happy about these changes because to become more efficient, they had to use more complex engines, which was expensive. So they convinced the government that big cars should be exempt for those rules because they were mostly used by small businesses such as farmers or contractors. And so the increase in prices would hurt their business. So then a category which was known as light trucks became exempt from the tighter rules.
Ah, so what is called in that system a light truck is actually, well, how America got its big cars.
Yes, exactly. And light trucks are very loosely defined. So SUVs, which are among the least efficient cars, also fit into that category. A light truck is simply any vehicle that can be used off-road and weighs less than 8,500 pounds. And light trucks are marketed like crazy. The car makers have spent huge amounts of money advertising them, especially SUVs and pickup trucks. When I moved to America, I remember being very surprised by how much they were advertised and how big the cars were. And probably many American listeners are also familiar with the commercials for the Ford F-150s, the Chevy Silverados, or the Dodge Rams.
This is the all-new Ford F-150, the future of tough.
Built with honor, Ford with pride, guts, glory, Ram.
The Chevy Silverado with the available multi-flex tailgate.
Walter, go get some firewood.
Find new adventures, find new roads, Chevrolet.
The advertising worked. By 2002, light trucks made up a bigger share of light-duty vehicle sales than cars. But new regulation is coming soon.
That is to say that the loophole that created this category is going to close? What is it that's coming?
Yes, so environmentalists have long campaigned for the stricter rules on what is classified as a light truck. And I spoke to Dan Becker, who is at the nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity. And he said that car makers make more money on large vehicles, but that they are a big issue when it comes to climate change.
Biggest single step that we can take to cut our global warming pollution is to make vehicles use less gasoline by becoming electric.
And so the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, is working on implementing new rules. And this is the federal agency that regulates tailpipe emissions. And they announced last year that they would tighten efficiency standards across the board and that they would narrow the definition of light-duty vehicles.
So essentially, the law is going to do away with that category? Is it going to do away with the loophole altogether?
No, the definition is still going to exist, but there will be less cars that fall into that category. So the definition of a light truck is going to be tightened. So just to give you an idea, currently the difference in emissions that cars and light trucks are allowed to emit is 71%. And by 2032, this is going to be 22%.
So what does that mean then on the showroom floors? Does that mean that the kinds of cars that Americans love will get more expensive, or will the kinds of cars that Americans end up buying just be smaller?
Essentially, what the EPA is trying to do is to get Americans to buy electric. So by making regular cars more expensive to build, it hopes that it will force car makers to build more electric cars. But the problem is that car makers also love making huge electric vehicles, and the EPA doesn't regulate the size of EVs. So I think that cars will continue to be very big.
Just some of them will be electric.
Yes, exactly.
Carla, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Jason.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show by emailing us at podcasts@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem
where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.